This episode of the Sportsman's Empire is brought to you by Interstate Batteries. Since 1952, Interstate Batteries has been evoking compassion and a trustworthy spirit into the surrounding communities. Interstate Batteries is a mission-driven company fueled by purpose and guided by their values. If you need help locating a specific battery, stop into your local Interstate Batteries retail store and speak with a battery specialist. They even offer cell phone repairs. Interstate Batteries. Outrageously dependable. All right, ladies and gentlemen, this is the Nine Finger Chronicles podcast, and this is episode number 2 of our spring series with my man Pierce from the Wisconsin Sportsman podcast. Pierce knows a lot about Wisconsin. He hunts and fishes in Wisconsin. He lives in Iowa, which is good.
I'm a cheater.
It's not, dude, you're not a cheater, because all you're doing is taking advantage of living in Iowa, which is awesome. And then going and getting an over the counter deer tag in Wisconsin. Mm-hmm. And you're not the only person who does that. I know plenty of people, dude. I know guys who move to Northeast Iowa and they only hunt Iowa public because there's a good amount of it in Northeast Iowa, a decent amount.
Yeah.
Southeast Minnesota has good public. Southwest Wisconsin, even like an hour or two into Wisconsin, has good public. Mm-hmm. So there's this trifecta area where there's a lot of people bouncing around to three different states every year trying to fill tags. Dude, I know them.
Yes, sir.
I know them.
Dude, it's so. I didn't expect it to be as convenient as as it really has turned out to be. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like, Cause I love to go back and I'll gun hunt the opener. Like that's a non-negotiable for me. It's like Wisconsin opening weekend gun season, like gotta be there. Absolutely. So it's like, if you're going to bow hunt it and you're going to gun hunt it, like, all right, we're $400 into a state. That's okay. Yep. Could be a heck of a lot worse in other states there. But like, yeah, like you said though, like you want to add Illinois in the mix. If you're further south down there, I mean, there's a lot of good ground over there. And I think, I don't know what an Illinois tag is now. Like, what is it, like 3-something?
Yeah. If, I mean, and if then, even if you wanted to do that, that's 4 states.
Right.
Really close. Really
exactly.
Close. Yep. And so like even I know guys who live in Southeast Iowa and they hunt public in Illinois. They hunt public in Missouri, although Missouri's rules sound like they're going to be changing here pretty soon and they're going to go to a draw system as well, which is probably needed because I think there's been a lot of people taking it because Missouri was $2? Or just one.
I think it was a $2 state.
$2 state. Yeah. So you could go in there and smoke two deer. Yep. Same with Illinois. You could go over to Illinois, smoke two deer. I mean, if you played your cards right and you had no family and you were obsessed with hunting, then you could fill a lot of tags.
Yeah.
like if you were in living in Eastern Iowa, getting that premier tag every year and then bouncing around to the rest of the states, you know, based off of whatever your schedule was.
Yeah, dude. Okay. So on that note, if you had to pick 3 states, one of them has to be Iowa, right?
Okay. Because would we live here, right?
Yeah. Would you rather do, like say as an Iowa resident, hunt, like I guess be in that northeast corner and then you've got Iowa, southeast Minnesota, western-ish Wisconsin. So you're dealing at that point, you're dealing with that like Buffalo, Trempealeau County, that kind of area up there. Would you rather bump further south? Do east central Iowa, southwest Wisconsin, northeast or northwest Illinois, or go further south, southeast Iowa, southern-ish Illinois, and then maybe dip down to Missouri?
My gut tells me this is just because I don't know anything about Illinois. It's a state that I've never, like, I've looked at a little bit of southern Illinois public, but And just like talking with people about there's certain times of year where some guys that I talk about say that it's dead and you can run into some good deer down in southern Illinois. And it's like there's a couple really big national forests down there.
Yeah.
But my gut tells me that southeast Minnesota, northeast Iowa, southwest Wisconsin would be better than adding in Illinois and taking away Minnesota or adding in Missouri and taking away Wisconsin and Minnesota.
Totally.
And adding Illinois. So my gut tells me northeast Iowa, I was going to move up there and hunt those 3 states would be better than the other options. That's my gut.
No, definitely, dude. I totally agree. And I think just from a population density standpoint, too, that if you're trying to like fill all three tags, which you were obviously trying to, but like, I think your odds of crossing paths with solid bucks that you're going to fill those tags with across the board, dude, I don't know.
And it's a no brainer, right? Like, you let's just say, oh, I'm going to focus on my Iowa tag because that's what I have. I want a good buck in Iowa. You shoot that buck, hop across the river. Over the counter tag, Wisconsin, right there, right? Why not?
Mm-hmm.
Why not? So,
yeah. Dude, it's tough though, because I like even just hunting the two states last year, trying to get myself to like just lock in on one state is really tough because it's always, especially if you're running cameras and stuff, like they're starting to pop off that first week in November. And last year, I was like, well, I'm hell bent on filling my Iowa tag.
Yeah.
And then Wisconsin will come later. Because worst case scenario, then I've just got a totally fresh piece that I can go hunt during gun opener, right? Ideally, it's untouched. Ideally, the deer kind of viewed as a safe haven. But I mean, yeah.
Did you hunt Wisconsin public this past year?
Yep. Yeah.
Oh, with archery or gun?
Yeah, archery. Yeah.
Archery. Yep. Is there a noticeable difference just crossing the river from Iowa into southwest Wisconsin?
That's tough, man. Yes. Not.
Yes. Pressure or terrain?
Dude, way more pressure. Way more pressure in Iowa. Way more pressure.
See, I want to stop you there for a second because, dude, Iowa is not what you think it is for these guys coming in hunting public.
Yep.
Yes, we manage our tag allocation very well, but you are going to run into other hunters if you're just bouncing public. When I was bouncing public years ago, even back then, when you could get an Iowa tag, I would say once every 2 or 3 years, dude, there was still a lot of people spending 2 weeks in Iowa. And now it takes four, depending on what unit you plan on hunting, it takes 4, 5, 6 years to get a tag, especially if you're going to hunt southern Iowa. Mm-hmm. You're going to be running into people, especially because what you're doing is you're saying, okay, 6 years, it's taken me 6 years to get this tag. I'm going to go to southern Iowa. I'm going to bounce around on public. I'm going to give myself 2 weeks, but you and 100 other people are doing the same thing.
Yep. Dude, that's the thing. People don't factor in the competition level there. Cause if you're willing to wait 6 years for that tag, like chances are the other people who are doing the same exact thing are pretty damn good hunters and they're pretty freaking serious about it.
Yeah.
So like you're going in there and everybody wants, you know, whatever that, you know, pick a zone. They want that zone. They've been looking at the same public that you've been looking at. They're all ready to go deeper into that piece than anybody else is seemingly or whatever. And it's like, dude, if you're going in there thinking that like, okay, I drew an Iowa tag, even if it's like a zone 9 tag, right? Like a Northeast Iowa tag that takes you, what, 2, 3 years or whatever to draw. Dude, you are going in there with all the other serious non-resident hunters.
Yeah.
And like I had a buddy this year come over. He was in zone 7. And I think he waited 3 years, 4 years for that tag and hunted public, ran around, got permission on some private and I mean, like decent pieces of private, like stuff that looked like they were pretty tore up. But I mean, dude, he ended up coming home empty handed, had encounters. But like to come in and think that like Iowa is going to be a layup.
Yeah.
It's like definitely, it's definitely humbling, dude. Like it's awesome because you're right. Like we absolutely have the caliber of deer that everybody wants to hunt. And there's a pretty good number of them. But
everything you see is on private.
Dude, it's managed, all on private.
It's all managed private.
And they're still big, mature bucks. They're smart as hell. You know what I mean? Like they've had every, you know, whether it be slugs, muzzle loaders, you know, crossbows, compounds, whatever. They've had arrows and projectiles flung at them pretty much their entire life, depending on where they're at, unless they're like really heavily insulated by private. But even then, I mean, the chances of them having never had a bad encounter are pretty dang slim, dude. I mean, I don't know if I told you that story. I had that one on private. This is a piece that's never been bow hunted last year. I had a buck come off the neighbors that was chasing a doe and I grunted at him. I just like went full, like totally lost it, like went full freak out, grunted at him a bunch. And then finally I like snort wheezed at him and that son of a gun froze where he was kind of in this thicket. And then there was a forky and a doe with him and both of them kind of split off and I could hear them split off. It was, you know, light was fading and I sat in my tree and I was like, you know what? I think he left, but I don't know if he actually left or not. I'm going to give him an extra half hour after last light here before I get down, really make sure that I'm safe. So like 45 minutes go by and I really slowly climb down out of my tree or out of my stand. And I get on my top step and I go to reach around the tree to pull my stand down. And at that point, down in that same exact thicket, and this Joker literally didn't move a muscle for 45 minutes. He stood there and just looked up at me until I made a move and he was positive that it was either another buck or he was hightailing it out of there. So it's like you're crossing paths with bucks that have seen just about everything.
Right.
And I don't know. I think there's a lot of states. I think to the point of these other neighboring states, yeah, they may see plenty of pressure, but I think, I don't know, dude. I think they're hunted differently.
Yeah, I don't know, man. Summer is officially here. And you know what that means? Long late nights by the grill, weekends at the lake, and hitting the golf course with your buddies. And nothing elevates those perfect summer moments quite like a premium cigar. Whether you're pairing a rich Murado with a cold bourbon after a backyard barbecue or enjoying a smooth smoke on the porch at sunset, Thompson Cigar has you covered. They've been America's humidor since 1915, offering the absolute best selection and prices. Because they have one of the largest humidors in the country, your cigars are guaranteed fresh and delivered straight to your door. If you want to try something new, check out their unique 5-pack fever deals or their value clubs for unbeatable savings and expert curation. Use my code NFC at checkout for up to 20% off your orders of $75 or more. Or visit thompsoncigar.com/NFC and the discount will be automatically applied. Some exclusions may apply. I don't know. It's wonky. It's just, it's wonky. And Iowa Public has definitely grown in popularity for two reasons. One is because of the increase of people wanting to come, right? We have the cap on non-residents, you know, every year, however many people draw. The other is the displacement of locals who, you know, every time a piece of property sells, and if it's good deer hunting habitat, that deer hunting habitat is going to get managed for deer hunting or some guy, let's say, for example, if I bought 50 to 100 acres, I'm going to go in there and whoever is hunting that is going to have to go bye-bye and they're going to have to go somewhere else to hunt, whether that's permission or they like whatever the case is, that's other hunters that are getting displaced. These guys are going to public now. Okay. Yep. Especially in Southern Iowa. I shared camp that not this year, but the previous year with guys who are up in your neck of the woods, Northeast Iowa or North Central Iowa, and they drive all the way down Interstate 35 to commute to public in Southern Iowa. So not only are local, like non-residents doing it, but locals are doing it as well because you cut the state in half, the northern section's all ag. So yeah, but people are probably bored of hearing that shit, you know, like, oh God, here we have another Iowa conversation and public land, blah, blah, blah. Meanwhile, there's guys out in Michigan and, Pennsylvania and New York who are literally laughing at us because they're like, oh, you think your public's bad, dude? Check out what we have to deal with, right? And that's been the, but then you have other guys, dude, like it's gotta be some kind of like, how do I put this? Like it's gotta be some kind of mental state or how hard are you trying to work? Because there's so many guys out there every year that just laugh at comments like this.
Yep.
And they're like, oh yeah, it's really pressured. And then they're laughing. Oh yeah. Yep. Pennsylvania sucks. Oh yeah. Michigan sucks. Meanwhile, there's dudes out there getting the job done because they're willing to just be more flexible and put in more hours and all the same shit you've heard for the last 10 years. Mm-hmm. Right. So yeah, there's that.
Yeah. I thought Iowa Public was more fun than the private pieces that I had access to.
And why honestly. Is that?
I think I told you this. I lived here there was a delay in getting my residency switched because mm-hmm. I had already purchased a Wisconsin fishing license. They don't expire until the following March or something. So I was trying to apply and they're like, hey, you got an active Wisconsin license still. I was like, what in the heck's going on? And so I ended up getting that sorted out finally. But as a result, because I was sitting there like, well, I'll probably have that sorted out by fall or by shotgun mm-hmm. or by muzzle or whatever. I'll be ready to go by then. I was still doing a bunch of scouting for like a year prior. You know what I mean? So it was basically yep. like I was hunting an out-of-state hunt and being able to do a bunch of, I don't know. It's like I was waiting to draw a tag, basically. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? I was just doing that yep. preemptive scouting. And so, dude, I've scoured so many different pieces across this really eastern half of the state that, I mean, every single one of them's got a honey hole. Every yeah. single one of them. You know what I mean? And you got to figure
pocket,
out.
A pocket of something.
Yep. Exactly.
Yep.
Exactly. And it might, yeah. you know, it's like anything. I'm not going to like reinvent the wheel here, but, you know, it's it's going to be one of these pieces is great during the rut. One of these pieces is great early season. One of these pieces is great late season. They've all got different aspects of, or one of them's just got great bedding cover, whatever it may yeah. be. Like, yeah. you know, they've all got something. And
when you cross, because here's what I've heard from other guys. Mm-hmm. When you cross the river in southwest Wisconsin and you do your scouting and all of a sudden you run into a, at least this is what I was told. I want to see if it matches up with what you've seen. Southwest Wisconsin, you go into a piece of public and you're just like, oh, dude, this spot is money. This is a great spot. Look at these trails. Look at this sign. Boom. Tree stand right there.
Yeah.
Is that your same? You're seeing tree stands in these honey holes or not?
Depends on the size of the piece, honestly. I think some of those bigger pieces that are easily spotted from that kind of like zoomed out view on Onyx, the ones that people are like, well, I want to, you know, pick a chunk that's either got a high cluster, like a high density of smaller pieces, or I want to pick a piece that's just a big ass, you know, 2000 yeah. acre chunk. I can't tell you which one's better or not, but
yeah,
across the board, if there's a piece like that where you're like, ooh, like this, I don't know, the early bench or whatever, or like that point that overlooks the lot.
Yeah.
Those all have stands in them. But I think yeah. the further back you go, I don't think Wisconsinites have the, I don't know. I've noticed in Iowa, like, dude, you can be 2 miles back on a chunk. And there will still be a ladder stand with new straps on it, like maybe like fresh out of the box. The paint's not even faded on it. There's a rope-a-dope scrape hanging down there or something like that. And I'm like, dude, what the hell is wrong with you that you like had the gumption to haul an 80-pound stand 2 miles back into the, like down in this ditch across a river, like into this hell hole. Just to like lock into this tree, you know what I mean? I can justify yeah. it with a mobile setup because it's like, hey, I can get into, I'm hunting this area, right? Because I can yeah. lock in here. I can throw a sit at that tree. And then if I need to adjust, I can do that. But like these guys that come in at the ladder stand and just commit hardcore yeah. to this is my tree. This is where I'm going to be. This is what's going to happen. And I'm riding it out for the rest of the season. And they probably rut hunt it. And then they bring the shotguns in there, the muzzleloader in there too.
Yeah.
And so I'm sure they get some.
They probably put that stand on a four-wheeler, to be honest
yeah,
with you.
True,
and
true.
They're driving back there.
Yeah.
Whether the DN, like, there's not enough DNR to just all of a sudden be like, okay, well, you're gonna have to stop driving your four-wheeler. They have no clue what's going on all mm-hmm. this public land, right? There's not yeah. enough. They're so worried about poaching and other wild game violations that if some dude's transporting a four-wheeler down, they don't have enough time for that. And we don't right. have enough coverage for that. But yeah. outside of that, dude, like, in Iowa, you're supposed to only have your stands up at what I believe 2 weeks before the season starts, and then something you have like 30 days after the season ends to take your tree stands down. Mm-hmm. That law is not being enforced at all.
No,
because not every time I go shed hunting on public, I see tree stands that have definitely been there enough years to where the tree is stretching the straps out. You know mm-hmm. what I mean?
Yep.
And so totally. The tree is growing into the straps. And so, dude, I know guys who just, they don't tolerate it and they will have pin locations, then they'll go find a DNR officer and be like, found a tree stand here, found a tree stand here. And they'll rat out a whole bunch of people as well. And so, yeah, dude, I don't know.
I know Wisconsin's laws are different than Iowa. Like Wisconsin, you're not allowed any permanent sets. Like you can't leave anything in the woods
overnight.
You're not supposed to. No,
but they do. But they do. And I think that's where like, I don't hear this as much anymore, but when I started podcasting, you walk into an area, let's say this is when mobile hunting was starting to get really big. You roll into an area, you've set up your stand in the dark or even in an afternoon hunt, and then some guy starts walking through the woods and you start to maybe shine him or you're waving your hand so he sees you and he just keeps walking. And he keeps walking, you know, whatever, public land is public land. And then they say, I've been hunting that ladder stand for 25 years.
Yep.
I've been hunting here for 25 years. Like that's supposed to change anything, right? I'm hearing less of that now for some reason. And maybe it's because some of those guys are starting to age out of that part of their life. I don't know. Where they're, you know, like obviously if there's less people on public, you're going to go to the same spots that produce for you every single year. And this new generation of mobile hunters comes in and they start to, you know, they're mobile. They're dipping and diving and going in, checking sign, looking for fresh sign, getting in into people's areas that they've never had anybody come in to before. There's going to be, you know, I don't want to say an altercation, but there's going to be
like friction,
two hunters meeting each other. And, you know, and then as that generation starts to age out and they don't hunt as much anymore, then these mobile guys are starting to have a little bit more freedom throughout but my gut tells me there's more of the mobile guys hitting the public than the standard tree stand guys anymore. You know what I mean? Like they're kind of aging out.
Yeah,
definitely. And that could be just an assumption too.
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, I think it makes sense because if you've got those guys who are fully committed to like, I'm going to go in and I'm going to hang a permanent set or a ladder stand in here. I'm going to take the effort to do that. Chances are they're trying to be in their own way as efficient as possible, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. And so odds are opening weekends, Saturdays, Sundays, peak rut, all that sort of stuff. It makes you wonder too, like, as there are more mobile hunters who are starting to like push into these areas that weren't previously, you know, messed with.
Yeah.
I would imagine that some of those guys who have had that ladder stand for 25 years, who are now starting to encounter people on that Saturday, on that Sunday, you know, whatever it may be, on those like peak, you know, activity times for hunters. I would imagine that they, after a couple of encounters, are like, this place is just getting hammered. I'm out of here. I'm not hunting this anymore. And I think it's maybe painting like a little bit of like a less accurate picture. Like if you only hunt on Saturdays, you're going to think every public piece in the state is, you know, hammered. Just an absolute zoo. But if you hunt on Wednesdays or Tuesdays or Thursdays, whatever, like you can probably start to then have I don't know, it's like the other side of the coin, because it's like you're hunting on Tuesday, Wednesday. There's no other cars there, but you didn't know that there were like 14 guys banging through the woods all weekend.
Couple days. And then, and then add in like late October and the first 2 weeks of November where people are getting smashed in, you know, like everything's getting hammered. Mm-hmm. This is what it kind of going back to what you were talking about and everybody's coming in. Dude, this is where what I would tell people. If you want to come hunt a state, I don't know. I don't want to say especially Iowa, but you might want to think about that last week of October, and you might want to also think about that third week in November. Because here's what happens. This is what I've noticed in Iowa, especially on public. The locals, they're crushing it the first week of November. They're getting in there. That's what I did because I couldn't contain myself. They're blowing their load the first week in November. And then maybe if they haven't killed yet, they'll trickle in. But for the most part, then vacation time's up. Then family gets stressed out unless they get, you know, unless they live close to the places. But if you're having to travel an hour or more to get to your hunting locations, like driving 1 hour for an afternoon hunt and then coming back home and then driving an hour for a morning hunt, no matter how far away you live, that tends to add up, and people get sick of doing that for, you know, so many days, right? Five days, 10 days, whatever. And so I would say, like, dude, if you're looking to maybe run into something, I would say, and avoid a lot of pressure, forget about the first 2 weeks in November, hunt the pre-rut, hunt the backside of the rut, into the, I don't even want to say post-rut, but the trickle, as the rut starts to trickle off. And then that's when a lot of those big dogs are on their feet, man. And they're still looking, they're stupid, and you're going to see less deer, but you're going to have the chance of seeing a monster is really good.
Right.
I think anyway.
Dude, it's such a different headspace to be in though, especially if you do hunt that first week in November and then you see nine.
You have to be patient. You have to be so much more patient and calm. You know, your rattling probably isn't going to work as well. Your blind rattling, any type of calling is going to probably not work as well. And you're going to need to just be in the right terrain feature, honestly.
Yep. Dude, 100%. So, yeah. It's, if you're expecting it to be like November 6th or 7th or whatever, like it's not. Like at that point, like they've gotten bumped so many times and those bucks are so wary. They've, you know, been rattled at, grunted at, snort wheezed at, bleak can, rattle bag, whatever. They've heard it all.
They've not only heard it all, but they've also heard it after they've been downwind of the hunter. Mm-hmm. Right? Like all of a sudden, I have it on film, this 180 inch typical 12. And I'm reliving it right now with my eyes closed. He's coming in. He catches my wind. He turns around. He walks away. I grunt at him. I rattle at him. I snort wheeze at him. And I never saw that deer again. Right? Like, of course you didn't, dumbass. Mm-hmm. You threw everything at him. You could have just sat there, let him catch your wind, and then maybe try to catch him on another point somewhere.
Yep.
Nope. I just said, I have no chance at this deer. I'm never going to have a chance at this deer. So I just ruined it for the rest of this deer in my life. So big mistake. And that's what guys are doing. They're tough doing it.
Yeah. And it's tough, man. Cause it's like, especially if it's like, say that's day six of your 7 day trip or whatever, like you're not going to not call at them. You know what I mean? I don't know. Yeah. It's so tough. Cause it's like overcalling to turkeys. You know what I mean? All you're doing is just educating them. Yep. And it's so tough to get out of that headspace of, okay,
how do I shut up?
Yeah, shut up, calm my adrenaline down, just get like, put the bow down, grab the binos instead, and like watch diligently what that buck does to get through that area or where he goes. If it looks like he's headed into a little thicket, like maybe you can play a set for the next morning or even like move around and get in there that afternoon, depending on when it happened. But dude, it's not easy to do. Yeah.
No, it's not. And on that point, we got to do a little bit of a commercial break here, but we have a new partner today on the Nine Finger Chronicles I'd like to talk about. And that's my grandma's coffee cup,
right? Yes.
You see this thing?
Yes, sir.
This is my grandma who is no longer with us. I know she's in heaven because she was an amazing person. Her name was Darlene, and this is, I don't know if you're watching on YouTube, you can see this. It is a butterfly on some, I'll just call it pollinator type of plants. It is a blue butterfly, and it's got some kind of brass knuckle type looking finger holes, which are my favorite, by the way. And when my grandma passed away, my aunt came up to me and she's like, is there anything out of this house that you want? And I was just like, not really into it. And so I opened up and I said, I want this. This is the only thing that I took out of my grandma's house. And so, shout out to Grandma Darlene Johnson. You are missed, but I remember you every time I drink out of this coffee cup. So shout out to my Grandma Darlene. By the way, Grandma Darlene, she made some of the most badass, these like vanilla wafer cookies with a lemon frosting on it. Holy, you match that with a cup of black coffee. Holy shit, your day just went from shit to awesome. All right. So shout out. There's no discount code for Grandma Darlene, by the way.
Nope. There's nope, just one of one.
Yeah, one of one. So shout out Grandma Darlene. All right. So on the other side of things, we got Wasp Archery, man. If you want some of the best broadheads on the market, in my opinion, most of their heads are still manufactured in the United States. Go check out wasparchery.com. Discount code NFC20. Next on the list, we have Vortex Optics. It's still turkey season. There's still, if you're hunting that late season, that fourth season in Iowa, if you're hunting that later season in a lot of the other states, then go get a red dot. Vortex makes it very simple to put a red dot on your turkey shotgun. You may have to do a little tapping and drilling, but other than that, you take it to a gunsmith. If you don't have the, what do they call that? A Picatinny rail already on it. You attach your red dot. And then you shoot turkeys in the face, dude. That's what one of my favorite things. Just, dude, my buddy over at, I gotta share a quick story. My buddy over at Vortex, his name's Eric Barber. He sent me a video, or he posted a video of a Tom taking a completely full choke load to the face. And I know that sounds really brutal, but it is one of my favorite types of videos to capture. Like, you know, when you see a buck get double lunged and you're like, that buck's dead. Yep. When you see a turkey take, and like, he popped his head up, he's like, hey, what's that? Boom. The shot put of shot to the face, flopped dead. That's an amazing thing. So anyway, shout out to Eric Barber for putting one hell of a shot on a turkey's face. And I don't know if Vortex really accepts that as a commercial, but Vortex
that's
Optics.
Just proof of concept, right?
Exactly. Yeah. There you go. I like that. Proof of concept. So shout out Vortex Optics, vortexoptics.com. Next on the list, we have Code Blue Sense. Real synthetic deer urine, scent elimination products. My favorite is the Rope-A-Dope mock scrape kit that they have. I use that paired with my Reveal cell cams to, especially early season, to get inventory of the deer that are on their farm. And from a mock scrape standpoint, it's not just bucks. You get to see fawns. I like my trail cameras when I see a little fawn head kind of poking up and trying to smell the rope. Does visit it throughout the year. Bucks, obviously, when we get into the pre-rut and when their antlers go hard, they're starting to make sign and check that out. So go visit codebluesense.com, discount code NFC20 for 20% off. Outside of that, then we have Reveal trail cameras. They have the new Ultra. I'm going to get some more information on the Reveal habitat stuff that they've just introduced. So I'm not up to date on that yet, but they have a brand new app that they've just introduced along with updates to their current cell camera app. Lots of cool, features, including mapping, being able to drop pins, highlighting deer and keeping all of that stuff organized. Go check out tacticam.com/cameras and download the app wherever apps are downloaded. Last but not least, if you want a t-shirt with a deer on it, fullsneakgear.com. Go check it out. All right, Pierce. I kind of want to go back to the term honey hole with you. Bouncing around, and really this isn't just a public thing. It's a private thing as well. When you use the term honey hole, what does a honey hole mean to you?
Oof. I mean, I think it's just an, like, for deer, like we're talking about, I think it's right. An area that consistently funnels a lot of movement through it. You know what I mean? I would say that. Either that, or it's like that one bedding area that never gets messed with, which I guess in that case, that would be more of a sanctuary than a honey hole per se. But like, dude, I think there's honey hole makes it sound like there's,
it's chip
it's
shop.
Like a big zone, you know what I mean? Like a big area, but I think it's that one spot right on the edge of the bluff where your thermals are just bulletproof and bucks have to go over that spot. It's that one just like primo pinch point or that one scrape that just lights up and it's like got bulletproof access up at the head of a drainage and like you can get in, get out bulletproof. And it's just like, it's your annual producers, I think. Yeah.
Yeah. What's that look like? If you were to close your eyes and envision like a Midwestern honey hole.
Dude, what, I think what, it's...
Like, describe it for us.
The one that jumps to mind is like the one that I shot my buck on this past year in Iowa, where you've got basically a convergence of ag fields. You've got some terrain elevation. So basically there's two upper fields with a fence dividing the two. It's a property boundary. There's a strip of timber that's maybe 200, 150 yards wide, but that's dropping, I don't know, 100 feet, 150 feet or so. Yeah. And then down in the bottom, you've got another field or two down there. So like this one, it's basically just, you've got that pinch point of like the deer aren't going to run through like a field of standing corn. They're not going to run through a picked wide open cornfield during daylight. They're going to be condensed down to use these fence lines, to use that edge, to use that pinch point, and they're going to funnel and pinch down through that stuff. That's what jumps out to me is just those areas where they have to go pretty much.
Yeah. And they have to go there. Why? Why do they have to be in this little area? Because I know of a, I'm not going to call it a honey hole, but I'm going to call it a really good pinch. And this really good pinch is in wide open, big, mature timber, right? And the reason they have to go through there is because they have two options. They have to drop down a giant bluff into a creek bottom, or they have to hop a fence and go in, expose themselves in the middle of a pasture, or they have this 100 yard strip of timber that connects two big drainages together. And that's way more convenient for them, but it's wide open. There's no, like, it's just giant trees. There's some smaller trees in there. Don't get me wrong, but it's more convenient of a travel corridor for them throughout the day than it is, let's say, like a honey hole bedding area, which is nasty. You know what I mean?
Right.
So when you say they have to be there, what's that mean?
Well, dude, kind of like we talked about last week, just anytime I think you can put a water feature, like a river or a creek bottom or something that's just going to, or a bluff, whatever, something there that's going to be like, this is going to be a bitch to get through. Yeah. And so with the bluffs, with the water, all that sort of stuff, like it creates a thermal vacuum for you. So you've got one like somewhat, you know, weather depending, obviously, like if you get a 20 mile an hour wind, it's not going to matter as much. But like if you get on a fairly calm day, you've got something that's just going to consistently create that thermal pull so that you can get in and get out undetected. But for the deer, they're either swimming or they're going straight up a bluff or they're going to be out in the wide open. So like this place lays out, it's got quite a bit of scrub brush in there, a lot of like honeysuckle bushes and stuff. So there's a lot of like horizontal cover for them down low. But there's also a tractor trail, a four-wheeler trail, like kind of just little things in there that create openings in the canopy, or not in the canopy, but like in the forest floor that they can feel secure. They're down below kind of like this knoll, so like nothing's going to spot them from like way out in the field or anything. It's a very secluded, kind of intimate little pocket that they can travel through, and they're only exposed 30 yards on either side pretty much. So just where they had that security, we have that peace of mind. And you know, obviously there's a bedding pocket in there as well, so that helps certainly. But that's kind of very similar to like what you said. It's either wide open, they're on like a mowed trail or a picked corn field going across the top of this ridge, or they're like basically playing mountain goat and they're side hilling this more or less vertical bluff, which they'll absolutely do. But that's like, that is the strip of timber connecting one cornfield to, or like one block of ag to essentially like a big CRP type thing in the bottom that then leads to other stuff.
Are there two different doe groups on each side of that little strip of timber, or do they travel through like from, does that strip of timber include like a bed to food pattern?
Yes, 100%. Okay. Yeah. So there's bedding like basically in like the center of the strip of timber, there's kind of a little bench. There's like three little ridge points that kind of create this spot. The furthest one in below these pines, basically, which is kind of like a little mini hub in itself. Mm-hmm. Like it's just kind of a low point, so it sucks all the thermals from out in the ag field down right into that little bedding pocket. And so then from there, they can either run the timber line, what is that, east to west, or they can go south out into the field or north into the river. But
So I'll talk a little bit about what I think a honey hole is. Mm-hmm. And a honey hole for me is just like any place that deer feel comfortable.
Totally.
And what I mean by that is when they slow down, when maybe they bed there, maybe they don't. I'm thinking of places that are secluded from roads where I don't want to say they're far away, like they're 2 miles in deep, but a honey hole to me is a place where cars can't see in. Maybe the road is low and the honey hole's up high, or the honey hole's way low and you can't see it because there's a row of trees or the timber connects to it. But, and also something that light can get to that makes the vegetation thicker. And really with anything like that, access becomes more important into these areas, right? Like, let me try to think of a honey hole here. The first one that comes to mind is actually on a property that I can't hunt anymore, but it was this honey hole, or this property that I'm thinking about was a 80 acre square. Now you take that square and you put an X in it, right? All the corners connect, and right in the center was where two waterways kind of connected, and there was like a strip of timber. So it was almost like a Y instead of an X. Yep. So there was drainage from the south coming to that point, drainage from the northeast coming to that point. They connected, and then they turned into a creek that ran into a different property. And it wasn't necessarily thick, but it was this giant CRP field with mature oaks in it that made deer want to come there, hang out there. There was sprinkled in cedars in this CRP field that they just didn't cut out. And long story short, it became this area where deer just felt very comfortable, right? You couldn't see it from a road. Nobody's coming back there because for the most part, you had to have access through one area, or, you know, you had to have access through two properties if you wanted two different wind directions, which I did. And so it became a honey hole from just a standpoint where once I got in there in the morning, you sit there and you just watch deer absorb back into it from the fields. And it was interesting watching them because it always looked like they were in a hurry until they crossed some imaginary line, and then their bodies changed. They started to relax. They started to slow down. Maybe they would lay down for a little bit. Maybe they would stand up. You would start to see the does almost play a little bit. Mm-hmm. The bucks would, like, they would make sign, they would slow down, and they would all kind of cross right into this point where the two drainages met. And that's where I had the most encounters with the biggest bucks, and even up a little bit, depending on the wind direction, and another big mature oak tree that I can still remember. 11/11/11, November 11th, 2011, I didn't shoot a deer that day, but I saw the most 4-year-olds and older in a single hunt. My buddy Ryan Iberg was in the tree with me. I'm sure he remembers. I can even remember it was so awesome because we had two hot does come through this area, and he had already been hunting for like 11 days with me. So he called his wife. He's like, dude, I need one more day. She was pissed, but she was cool with it. And he stayed one more day. And of course the 12th was dead. Like, great, it was dead. Yeah. But dude, we saw like 4 4-year-olds and then like a 5 or 6-year-old 165, 70 inch giant 10. And it was just like the perfect day of hunting. But the reason why all these deer were in this area is because of how comfortable that they felt in it.
Totally.
And you can take that and but they all had one thing. They had a terrain feature. They had cover. They had seclusion, right? And so you start adding up all these things on all these boxes that we check off every single year, or every time we try to find a good location. Then you start to realize, okay, this is or is not a honey hole. You know what I mean?
Right. Definitely. Dude, and it's tough too, because I remember last year talking with your good buddy Tony Peterson about kind of hunting on memories and like having the idea of like, oh, that honey hole might be, it's that spot that I shot that buck 3 years ago, or it's that spot that I always see those bucks in there. You know what I mean? You get locked into some of these spots almost just like with hindsight bias of like, well, I've killed in here before, so I should be able to kill in here again. And you just get hung up on trying to like recreate that same success in the same exact spot and the same exact tree. And there are trees that you can do it in, right? Like there are trees and scrapes and hubs, and there are areas that you can do it in, but dude, getting locked into that headspace is a dangerous game to play.
Yeah, it's dangerous, dude. And so that's why you always have to be out looking for the next honey hole, because I'll tell you this, it's been probably 7 years now since my main property was logged, and that changed the entire structure of that. Okay. It meant that logged area got more sunlight and the deer started absorbing into that, right? It meant that it pulled them off of like, so on this one farm that I hunt, it was mostly big mature timber throughout all of the timber. And then, so what happened was they were bedding on the field edges a lot, right? Because the field edges get the most sun, which means it's thicker, and they want to bed in these thickets. And so they want to bed like where they feel comfortable. They logged it, and that sucked them back into the timber more, because there's more deadfall in there now, more light getting to the forest floor, and it created a thickness throughout the entire timber. So now terrain meant much more. It had much more importance now because of where they were bedding. They weren't just bedding in thickness. Now they had all the thickness they wanted. Now they were looking for that terrain as well, so they could be, you know, like if something came down the two track on a south wind, they could catch the scent blowing into the terrain feature now. So you had to now go and look for the everything new. And so as that timber started to grow up the next 4 years, 5 years, it became thicker in different spots. So it was a very, I don't know how to put this, an actively changing, constantly evolving bedding areas on this farm. And now I think that we've reached a point where these bedding areas are more stable now.
Sure.
Does that make sense?
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah.
Dude, and so, that's like, I don't know, it's a cool like thing to be able to observe on a property. And like, obviously you got to toe the line of like meddling with an area too much and like tampering with things and like having like there be too much change to a point where the deer finally, I think they'll reach a point where they're like, there's too much going on over here. This is annoying. But like that thing where you can just be patient and watch that thing evolve into what it's going to evolve into. And like, maybe we trim a limb here or two so that we, you know, open up a shooting lane, or we drop a tree just to like block off one of these trails and funnel some movement in a different direction. But dude, it's a little changes.
Yeah. And then, so when that happened, right, all of the other hunters on the property, they kept their stands in the same locations, right in the right in the same spots, because they all had ladder stands. Well, I know for a fact it changed things, right? And so because I was a little bit more mobile and I had different hunting gear, basically, I had mobile sticks and mobile stands and hang-ons, and they had ladder stands. And so that allowed me to be like, okay, well, I'm just going to adjust to this new deer movement and put myself in a position where a lot of these things are going to connect. And then the other thing is once I made those moves, I tweaked my access routes too. And so I go, okay, if the deer movement has changed, well, potentially my access routes into these spots need to change too. And here's something that I've learned. You do not know shit about where these deer are at in a given day, right? Like you think you do. And I know I even have some doe groups that I've talked about on before, where I'm just like, at 9 o'clock, they're coming through this little pinch every single day. And for the most part, they do. But when you then are coming from the same direction that they're coming from, and you're trying to backdoor away or J-hook in or trying to find a way into this tree stand, they know that you're walking through the timber. They can hear you. Even if they can't smell you or see you, they can hear you. They don't know what you are, but then that might change some things, right? And so I would not be afraid, especially on an access route, on an ever evolving or changing, change it up. Maybe 1 week or, you know, one day go in from like with the wind to your back. Maybe the next day go into the wind and see where you see the most deer movement. And it could be circumstance, or it actually could be how your access route impacts deer movement. I don't know. But play around with that stuff, man.
Dude, definitely. And yeah, so often it's like the finding that marginal thing where you feel like you're breaking the rules and you feel like, I don't know, if you've got a little bit of that, like,
yeah,
like hair in the back of your neck stands up a little bit, like you're like really feeling kind of antsy with every step you're taking, I think it's probably a good thing that you're like, that means you're like in the area that you're supposed to be. Now, obviously, don't go just like bombing in there on day one, trying to blow them out and be like, I'm going to roll the dice and see what happens. But
or you get that, you get that. I don't know. You've been there. If you've hunted long enough, we've all been there where it's just like, all right, I'm going to try this new access route to this tree. Dude, you're just, the wind is perfect. You know, the sun isn't up yet. You get in there, you climb up, you buckle up, you sit down, 30 seconds of just not moving. And then the doe blows and she blows and she blows and she blows and she blows for like 45 minutes the entire time the sun is coming up. And you're just like, well, that didn't work out like I planned. And then you're thinking about all the ways to murder this doe, right?
Yep.
Like, if I had a rifle now, she'd be dead. Bah, you know, like, you're so pissed off at how it turned out. But
yeah.
So outside of that, man, any, like, because I kind of want to name this episode Honey Holes, right? Anything else that you found out about honey holes that make it, that make a honey hole a honey hole?
Dude, like you said, I really like what you said there about it's when you find those areas that the deer finally slow down. Because we all know them. And especially like if you're hunting an area and ideally, you know, if you've got a mobile setup and you can make those tweaks, like I'm okay with burning, not like I say this gently, but like burning out a spot.
Right.
I'm okay with that to like confirm that those deer have adjusted their travel route up and around. I think one bump is not enough to get them to truly alter their path. And they might, they might still skirt you at, you know, another 50 yards up the ridge or something like that.
Yeah.
But dude, I think it's from what I saw as a youngin who would hunt the same ladder stand day in, day out, every evening after school, all that, not having a clue what I was doing. You know what I mean?
Right.
And then watch those deer continue. Like they'd go to the same area. Their destination hadn't changed, but just the route that they took to get there did. And they'd, rather than coming right through this little thicket, they'd come up, they'd maybe take a whiff, they'd maybe peek at that tree, and then they'd go up to the field edge, and then they'd walk that field edge, and they'd go up above, you know, I don't know.
Right.
60, 70 yards up up the hill from me, you know, but they were going to the same exact spot. And as soon as they got 60, 70 yards above me, whether they smelled me or not, or they saw me or not, like maybe if they didn't smell me, like they'd still check and they'd still be looking over there to a point where like they're not coming right under the stand. They're not coming in that 25 yard bubble that I had planned out back in August and, you know, that they did hit in September.
Right.
So I think like, I don't know. You can't view like a spot as truly like tapped until you, I guess that's the wrong way to say it. How do I phrase this?
Like worn out or overhunted?
You can't throw out an entire spot just because you bumped a deer or two out of it.
Oh, yeah.
I think it's okay because all you're doing is you're just you've shrunk the area that those deer are willing to move through that area. And if anything, you've just created a tighter pinch point by putting your own presence in there. But man, so it's like, if you can see the deer come in there and then maybe they get cagey, but like paying attention to where they finally, cause usually we can watch them for a while, you know,
paying
attention to, okay, they're on edge, on edge, on edge, on edge. Okay. Now they're like 80 yards away. Now they stop, they mill around, they're, you know, that body language changes, like you said. And then at that point, it's like, okay, great. Like, if that's the consistency that we're going to start seeing here, I'm going to move my stand this evening and I'm going to be right back there in the morning or you know, whatever it may be.
And you keep, pushing until you get a shot or you blow them out. Like, that's the point. That's the whole point of all of this. I will expand a little bit on honey hole, as far as I think my definition of a honey hole is probably like maybe different. Everybody's got a little bit different of what a honey hole is because I, of my hunting strategy, like I hunt doe groups, right? Like I'm the guy who I believe and how I've hunted and how I found my success is you find the honey hole or you find the doe groups and the doe groups that move through an area. And at some point throughout the pre-rut or the rut, a deer of whatever caliber you're trying to shoot is going to come through that area. And so for me, my make-believe honey hole or the honey holes that I always go to always have does. They always have does in them. And so because of my strategy and when I hunt and how I hunt, I'm always looking for the areas where the does are the most comfortable. Because if you got a doe on edge, like if you've ever seen a doe get downwind and then her body language goes tense or something spooks her and she goes tense, and then you've also seen it where that buck then now sees the doe go tense, then he automatically goes tense. And there's a lot of times where he's not waiting for her to blow or he's not waiting for her to flag. He just turns around and goes the opposite direction.
Yep.
Right. Nose to the wind out. Right. And so I feel like it's very important for that. For me and the way I hunt, I'm looking for areas where does are comfortable, where they close to where they bed, where there's maybe a small transition to whatever staging area that they kind of stretch and relax in before they go to destination food, or they're going and looking for an acorn tree or whatever the case is. It's there's areas where does are, and this is more for an afternoon hunt where the does are bedded. I'm creeping in close to maybe outside of that bedding area, not in the bedding area because I want to get close enough, but not close enough to spook them, where they stand up, they cross, you know, whatever imaginary lines or fences or terrain features to get to the staging area or whatever the case is. And they're comfortable in that area. And so those areas, again, have the good vegetation. They have good cover. They may even have some water where they can sip and drink before they move out. They have some kind of thickness and areas that don't have a ton of hunting pressure. And that's another big thing is just areas that are, dude, I don't know what other way to say it. And so then based off time of year, that's when the bucks move in. And that's when the sign, like I have this river bottom honey hole that I always go back to every single year. And it's right around that third to fourth week of October where the big rubs just start showing up. And I know then now it's time to go in and start to hunt that piece because of that, because the does are making their way through. They're not ready to breed. The bucks are following them or they're there and I get in and I can connect usually on something like that. So. Yeah. Yep. So long story short, go find your own honey hole, guys. Go find your honey holes.
Absolutely.
Anything else we need to talk about or elaborate on that?
Dude, kind of on the note of honey holes there, one thing I've been chewing on, do you believe in hot streaks?
Like hot streaks for a hunter?
Yeah.
Like, dude, I was on a hot streak in Iowa. Let's see, 16, 17, 18, 19, 20, 21, 22, 23, 24. 9 years.
Yeah, that's a hell of a streak.
And then the year that I didn't hunt, or that I didn't shoot one, which would have been 25, right? No, 24, I didn't shoot one. So that would have been 8 years. And then I shot one in 25. And so 8 years on a run, I was on a Dude, I was living my dynasty, my bow hunting mm-hmm. dynasty. Like I was just connecting with good deer every single year. There was one year out of that I shot a 2-year-old, but he was 140-inch 2-year-old, like just a genetic, just a genetic freak. Right. But when I walked up to him, I could have put him in my back pocket. Right. How can you blame a guy, right? He came in doing all the things, ears back, bristled up, like chasing off all these forkies. And then I was like, oh, shoot, he's a giant, you know? Mm-hmm. And then I come up and I'm like, holy shit, his tines and pedicles are small. But he had good mass. And anyway, other than him, I went on a run. And little luck, a lot of strategy went into some of these. But yeah, dude, I was on a hot streak. I just was clicking with the woods. I was just like, okay, I need to be here on this winds. I need to do all these things. Mm-hmm. And, but I think the year on 24, when I didn't connect in 24, I think a lot of it had to do with me potentially getting arrogant and being like, I'm just going to run, dude. I maybe got a little lazy. Maybe I started taking some straight lines to stands instead of following the low spots that I normally would have followed. Maybe instead of looping around the pond to avoid deer movement on my way out, I would walk right up to the pond wall and walk straight out and take some shortcuts that maybe impacted it. Another thing about 25 or 24 was that the caliber of deer were just not there that I was used to seeing. So I didn't necessarily...
Your head wasn't in as much. You didn't have that one that was eating at you.
Exactly. And then outside of that, dude, it was just like, I don't know. I don't know if I got lazy or my mind started shifting, or I don't know. Another thing was I passed up some good deer and then came back hoping that they were going to be there, but they were not. Mm. And so, that was the year where I had two deer coming through a funnel religiously. Like one was this 155-inch 8-pointer, beautiful, just like beautiful Iowa deer. And then I had this like 10-pointer with junk, maybe in that same 150, 160 class range coming through the same pinch point. I show up and they're gone. 2 days later, there's drones flying over my head. And I'm assuming they were looking for deer.
No.
So those two bucks disappeared. And then because they were cutting this corner on from the properties that I could hunt. And it's literally like a 50-yard trail, I'm assuming. And they probably had some guy down there in the bottom connecting on there. It's like it's honestly a good point. It's a good place to stage. And then after that, the 2 4- and 5-year-olds that I had on just were not there. And so I was just like, well, they're not here. Like, what am I doing here? Mm-hmm. Right. And so, I stayed and I kind of hoped something would show up that never did. And whatever. So then I took a break that year and then I started a new run this year. So
hell yeah.
I don't know. I'm hoping to start another run. How about you? You on a hot streak?
Dude, I just hit one this week, like just more so in a fishing sense. But I've been on like kind of a 3-year drought of like anything legitimately big. Mm-hmm. And I was screwing around on Smallmouth Creek in southwest Wisconsin and happened to just random, like, dude. And so, you know, like a Ned rig for smallmouth, like the little mushroom head jig thing. So I'll buy some of those. A buddy of mine who guides up on the Menominee up in the Northwoods, one of his buddies tied one of these, basically just a fly, but on a Ned rig hook, and basically imitates a crayfish. So I tied a couple of those this winter. And I was screwing around. I was like, it'd be fun to pick up a pre-spawn smallmouth. I don't know. Yep. What the heck? And I'm kind of working this like slow glide, pick up a couple smallies, and then I go back in there and I emailed with the fisheries biologist and he said like, there's like a couple of like holdover brown trout. And like, if you find one, they're usually pretty good, but you know, they're nothing. They're kind of few and far between. They're sort of this weird anomaly. We don't know where they come from, where they winter, where they, you know, spend the hot months of the year, what they do exactly. But I'm in this pool and make a little cast across, a little stack mend. And I'm kind of just like twitching my rod tip, sort of just trying to get this thing to like flutter across the bottom. And this thing just gets smoked. And I'm like, okay, cool. Like, great. Nice smallmouth. Should be great. And gets up to the surface and it's spinning around. And I'm like, it's kind of skinny. What is that, like a pike or something? That's kind of goofy. And then I get it a little bit closer and I get it on its side and I realize it's like 18-inch brown trout. I'm like, oh shit. I'm like, all right, that works. I got down, netted it. Great. Stoked. Next day, guiding these clients. And very first, I took one cast the entire day. And this was just to like demonstrate basically how I wanted them to retrieve, like how to do this like streamer retrieve. And I'm like, so we're going to go right type to this rock pile here. See that little shelf down below there? You want to land it on the rock pile, give it a couple strips off of there so it looks like a sculpin or a bait fish fleeing, but then it's out in open water. And then we're going to pause it there so it looks like totally exposed. And hopefully something's going to come up there. If not, it's going to sink a little bit. And then we're going to continue our retrieve. Slapped it off the rock pile. As I'm explaining this, twitch, twitch. 16-inch brown just comes up and chokes the thing.
So
I'm like,
oh, Jesus.
Trying to like shake it off. And I'm like, oh, shoot, that wasn't supposed to happen, but whatever. And like ended up having to net it anyways. And so I was like, all right, well, an 18 and a 16 and a turkey in a 72-hour span. I'm all right with this. This is
Good. You shot a turkey morel. Too. Yeah. And you found some mushrooms. Dude, that's like a win. Dude, that's just like nature telling you that you needed to be there.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Right.
However, I did read a story. I don't know if it was through Outdoor Life or where I read it, but there was a fishing guide up in, I don't know if it was Minnesota or Canada. And he was doing the same thing that he took the guys out. He said, okay, you see where the little ripples are on the water? Watch what I do. He throws it out there in the first cast just to demonstrate what he's doing. This fishing guide caught like a 54-inch muskie, just like this gigantic, just muskie. And I think they may have even been there for muskie. Yeah. And then he caught it. So it's just like, what do you do? You don't hand the pole to the client.
Right.
Right.
Yeah.
Because it's not their fish. They, it's like, oh, well, you know, it's only half mine, right?
Yeah.
That's crazy. And he told the entire story in that. But yeah, dude, hot streaks are real. And I feel like the more time you spend in the outdoors doing outdoor things, like you're gonna catch a hot streak. Now, for fishing, I've had the opposite, right? I've had really, really cold streaks where I'll be on a boat with my father-in-law and he'll throw, I mean, he's running the trolling motor, right? So he's the guy who gets into the spots first and he'll catch a couple fish and then I'll come in second and I won't catch shit, where maybe because he's the first one casting into these spots, he's going to get the first fish. But then there's other times where we've gone up to the Mississippi and we're just like absolutely crushing them. My father-in-law is actually on a hot streak right now where he went out to a spot. And I don't know what this means. He said he caught 23 tournament sized smallmouth. I don't know what tournament sized means, like from a weight standpoint, but he said his biggest one was over 3 pounds. And for a river smallmouth, that's pretty damn good, right?
Midwest.
And so I think he's like even like 3.4. And I think my biggest smallmouth on the Mississippi is 4.2. Mm-hmm. So. That was a great time. But when you're going in and you're just catching like 20, 30, 40 fish in a morning, or my favorite is throwing topwaters on mud flats, like head into current where the bait fish are jumping out of the water and you can catch those mornings, dude. Absolutely, man. Absolutely.
Hell yeah.
So
what's your headspace when you get on a hot streak? Do you acknowledge it? Do you like?
I don't know if I acknowledge it.
Mm-hmm.
I'm in it.
Yep.
I don't, for sure. Because I think what happened was I was on the hot streak, then I acknowledged it, and then I was like, I'm not in it anymore. You know what I mean? It's almost like
exactly.
It's almost like some of these 3-point shooters where they're just unconscious shooting threes and they're all going in. Yep. But then you start thinking about it and then it's brick, brick, brick. You know, something like that. Or guys who are on like hitting streaks where, you know, some of these guys are just like, dude, he hit 3 home runs in a game. And then the next game he was just like base hit. And then he's like, oh yeah, dude, I'm on a roll. Strikeout, ground out. You know what I mean? Like, I'm sure it has something to do with it, but mine obviously is more deer focused because I don't know shit about fishing. I just, you know, my father-in-law or someone tells me, you know, go cast it over there. Mm-hmm. And then I go cast it over. I'm throwing, you know, bobbers and worms and shit like that. Outside of that, dude, like, my goal is to get on another streak. But streaks only come from hard work, dude.
Mm-hmm.
And the second you're just like, you start to get lazy, then the streaks go away, man.
Yep. Absolutely.
But I've stepped into some years where I'm just like, I got it. Like, mm-hmm. I just felt like going into some of these years, not to sound arrogant, but I just felt like the deer's dead. He doesn't even know it yet.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Or exactly, some of these, dude. You can just sense it. Yeah.
Yeah. Now, I've never made any claims like some people have where they're just like, oh, yeah, I get a picture of him. He's dead in 30 seconds. He's dead in a minute. You know, like, I'm not going to ever say that shit. It took me some days to get to him, but I got to him because I knew his pattern. I knew where the doe groups were, and I just rolled with it, man.
Yeah. It's a wild claim to make. Those guys are just like, oh, if I get two pictures of that buck, he's
dead. I got 35 cell cams pointed on this food plot. And when he shows up, so do I.
Yeah.
I'm going to shoot him and then take my pictures. And then that's it. Like, I just, I don't know. That's
fun, dude.
That's not fun.
That sounds so lame. I don't know.
No, I use trail cameras, but like, not to that aspect, right? Like, I'm not popping out my window. Like, I'm not opening my window and shooting a deer from my, from my couch or walking down a lane because he's in the food plot and then just creeping up and shooting him from behind a tree. Like, I don't know. I like the chess match, dude. I like it too much.
Dude, exactly. Like, that's the reason we hunt is, like, to do the hunting. Like, the killing's fun, but not if you didn't feel like you earned it. Some crazy streak of luck came in, like, just put that deer, and you're like, holy shit, I was not expecting that. And then let her rip.
But, 100%. 100%.
Yeah.
All right, dude. Well, really good part two of the spring sessions, honey holes hot streaks. Honey holes and hot streaks.
There we go.
That seems like the title for this episode.
I love it.
Pierce, man, I really appreciate your time. Thanks to everybody who listens and who downloads and is subscribed to the Nine Finger Chronicles podcast. If you want more, go to iTunes or Spotify, wherever you download, leave a 5-star review and subscribe. We are also on YouTube. So if you want to go look at our beautiful faces and Pierce's beautiful mustache and my aging face, then go check it out at the Nine Finger Chronicles YouTube channel and subscribe to that. Outside of that, man, good vibes, everybody. I hope all of you you find a honey hole and you go on a hot streak this year. We will talk to you next week and we'll be ready for part 3 of the spring sessions. So yes, Pierce, sir. Appreciate your time, man.
You bet, man. Thanks for having me.